Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode bringing your attention to next weekend's 80th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, so you can prepare for Day of Remembrance observances near you. Sam Terasaki was one of 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry to serve in our armed forces during World War II. He was leading a mortar squad in Company A of the 100th Infantry Battalion, which by the time he made it overseas had become part of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
From November until March, the replacements kept coming over, more and more replacements to fill the depleted ranks.
Right. There were so many casualties, there were a lot to replace.
That's right. Then when we were considered full strength, well, that's when we shipped back to Italy. Didn't know it at that time, but when we came home with the regimental colors and had the honor of marching for President Truman, at that time it was Secretary of War Stimson, I believe, that told us that we were a unique outfit in that we were not under the jurisdiction of any one army or any one general or anything. They all had to go through the War Department. General Clark had the 100th Battalion in Italy. He didn't want to give them up, but Truscott in France wanted them from the invasion of southern France and for the battle into Germany. Clark lost out. The regiment, including the 100th Battalion, was sent to France. That's when they got involved, not only in the invasion of southern France. Some of the units flew into southern France on gliders.
Yeah.
Where they happened to end up rescuing the remnants of the regiment that was encircled. They were getting ready for the last offensive against the Germans, so Clark wanted the regiment back in Italy. So that's why we went from Italy to France and back to Italy, all the time in combat.
And I want to hear about what you experienced in Italy, but you just gave us an overview of the things that happened before you got there. And by the time you got there, this moniker, Go for Broke, I'm sure was well established. Is that something that you heard when you joined the unit?
Heard it more on the crap table than...
Uh-huh. Well, that's where it originated, right?
That absolutely is a Hawaiian slang for all or nothing. And the guys would be rolling dice on the army blanket and say, okay, and he's down to his last chips. I'll go for broke. Yeah.
What did that mean to you? I mean, if you have to explain that to someone who's never even heard that term and they say, well, why was 442 known as the go for broke unit?
Well, just explain to them. That's a Hawaiian term for... Yeah. All or nothing. I think the thing I remember most is when I came down from the mountains, checked in at the desk at the hotel where the rest center was, I saluted the captain. Actually, he was a dentist, Captain Komitani from Hawaii in the original 100th Battalion, and at that time was designated as a morale officer for the regiment. And I saluted him and told him my name, and he said, where are you from? And I said, Denver, Colorado. And he said, really? Because I took your sister out on dates. Turns out that he had gone to Denver University, and that's where my older sister had gone.
What a small world.
Small world.
That's crazy.
That's something you won't forget. But anyway, the other thing is, when my rest was over, well, we'd take all day to hike back to the top of the mountain. The number of the old-timers had just come back from New York. The old-timers in the 100th Battalion then were mostly from Hawaii, so they didn't get to go to Hawaii on rotation, but they did get to go back to the mainland. It just so happened that Captain Fukuda, who later became battalion commander, was in our group that were going back up the mountain to the outpost. As I said, it took all day to climb up there. So during one of our rest stops, and I don't know why he brought it up, except that I guess he was an educator in Hawaii before he was drafted. And he said, you know, I just came back from New York on rotation. He scolded some of the guys for practicing racial discrimination on their own, that you're all in the same boat. I don't know whether they realized it, but they looked down upon the African Americans at that time. I think there were some problems with the California Nisei and the Mexican laborers. Didn't treat them quite like they should have. So he just kind of lectured to us during one of our rests, climbing up back up to the outpost, which I thought was, in hindsight, is probably what you'd expect from a guy like Fukuda.
It was eye-opening for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was.
And why do I have the feeling that there were some eye-opening moments for you when you got to Italy?
Well, when we got to Italy, they gave us all new rifles and mortars and stuff. We did a little practicing. I guess one of the highlights was the fact that General Clark came up in a jeep to address the 100th Battalion, and knowing that we were going to go into battle, and the Battle of the Gothic Line, wished us well and welcomed us back to Italy and so forth. It was day after or so that night, I'm not sure which, and we pushed off and were hauled in the big open bed trucks up to the front lines and then walked the rest of the way up the hill in the dark until we were committed to battle in the morning of April 5th.
Were you prepared for what you were going to experience?
No, because I hadn't experienced anything like that where you're throwing grenades at each other. We set up our mortar in a foxhole that had been dug by American forces that were there ahead of us. My best army buddy, who was from originally from Oxnard, California, who settled in Atlanta, Georgia, Mike Doy, he and I were in the mortar squad that I was in charge of, set up our mortar, and while up above us, the guys in the rifle platoons were fighting.
So you're seeing things and hearing things and probably smelling things and experiencing things that you've never experienced before.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So bang. Only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you,
yeah,
and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, but he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. And it was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find that the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning of the 5th of April.
Your first day in combat.
Yeah, and they had their foot blown off, and the litter bearers, like I say, the trail up to the front lines was so narrow that they had to come by our gun emplacement. And
so you're seeing them come by one after one after the other.
Yeah.
And wondering when you're going to be.
Well, I remember two in particular. One, I didn't know him, but he was a rifleman, I'm sure, had stepped on a mine, and the litter bearers were taking him back to the first aid station, and he kept saying, itai, itai, which in Japanese means it hurts, it hurts. What was left of his foot, they put back on the litter because it had fallen off the side. It was hanging there by the skin. Another fellow that I remember was Lieutenant Novak, who was a platoon leader, and had his foot blown off. Oh, he was, even though they, I know they, medics must have given him a shot of morphine. He was still in pain. You could hear him moaning all the way down the mountain as they carried him down to the aid station. Novak He eventually became an MD, lost his foot, of course. And during one of our reunions, here's this rabbi that showed up at one of our reunions, and it turns out he was Lieutenant Novak's son, and he wanted to know if there were any guys around at the reunion that knew his dad. And there were a couple.
And there were a couple non-Japanese American members of these units. And some people don't realize that. They hear 100th Battalion or 442, and they assume every single member was Japanese American. How did you guys interact with those who weren't Japanese American?
Well, it was easy for me because I grew up in an all-Caucasian community, very few Japanese. Actually, it was kind of a cultural thing for me. For instance, I grew up with eating half the time Japanese meals, half the time American meals, meat and potatoes. Mm-hmm. But when we were in basic training and when we were overseas, we ate as much rice as we could get our hands on, trade our chocolate candy and cigarettes for rice when we were in Italy. Came home and always wanted rice, and my mother told my wife, my future wife, she says, I thought Sam was in the wrong army. He wanted rice all the time.
She thought you were wearing the rising sun, huh? You described for us April 5th, 45, your first day in combat. And people know that the war in Europe lasted another month beyond that. After experiencing that, seeing guys coming by with legs blown off, knowing that grenade landed so close that if the rock's not there, you're not there, how did you sleep that night? How did you cope with that on a daily basis moving forward?
I don't know. Those things you don't, at least I don't remember. I know we moved forward. Had to crawl through a minefield that the scouts had marked where the mines were, the same minefield that blew these guys' ankles off. Marked it with toilet paper, which we always carried. Take a sheet of toilet paper and put a little clot of dirt on it, and you knew it was safe to step there.
Well, that was my question. Did you know it was safe, or you just knew some weren't safe? It doesn't mean there aren't necessarily more out there that nobody found yet,
there
right?
There were more out there, but it just scared as hell and went ahead step by step, hoping that you didn't step on a mine that wasn't marked. We got through there and kept pushing the Germans back town to town from where we initially attacked to these little coastal towns, Massa, Carrara, where the famous marble quarry is, La Spezia, where the Italians had a naval base, Genoa.
And you're leading a mortar squad that entire time?
Yeah, carrying a mortar. Mm-hmm.
When you're firing that mortar, how frequent are those rounds, or what is that process like when you're in a position where...
Well, every time we would stop in a position, we'd set up our mortar and just wait for orders from the front, from the guys ahead of us.
You had a forward observer who's given you coordinates for a target?
Exactly. I know one time we set up our mortar in the marble quarry in Carrara, shooting straight, almost straight up over the marble mountain to positions that they thought they were in. I don't remember exact location was, but another time we set up our mortar and they called for some rounds, so we sent a couple of rounds over the mountain. And, you know, being a mortar man, you don't know. Whether
you never see what you're hitting.
That's right. The only thing on that particular time when we moved forward, we saw a bunch of bloody bandages and stuff like that. But we don't know whether.
You don't know if it's from you or.
No.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're firing a mortar, they start to figure out where those shells are coming from, right? And then you're probably taking some incoming also?
Oh, yeah. That was the thing that they worried the most. The artillery, you could hear it coming. Mortar rounds, you didn't hear it until it was just before it exploded. You hear a squish, bang. Whereas a German 88, you'd hear shoo, and then it would explode.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll find out how close those enemy rounds came to Sam. Again, to link to any of our interviews with Nisei vets as you prepare for this year's Day of Remembrance and the 80th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, head over to hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.